radio@firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Firecom makes wireless communication easy. Over the past 2 years, thousands of happy customers have discovered the benefits of Firecom's wireless headsets. Easy to use and simple to install, Firecom's wireless system is the industry choice for those who demand proven reliability and crystal clear communication. Whether on route, on scene, or during transport, a Firecom wireless system is a distinct advantage when performing critical life-saving services. To learn more about Firecom's complete line of communication products, contact your dealer, sales representative, or visit us online at firecom.com. Firecom, wireless made easy.
Good morning. It's the Apparatus Architects, Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand, live and in person with a great panel and a live audience here at Firehouse Expo in Baltimore, Maryland. Today, we are very pleased to have several folks from the apparatus industry who are very knowledgeable in their respective fields. And we have a list of questions that we're going to go down. We'll hit them one at a time as we go through. But introducing here, starting on my left, we have Jim Sommy, who's the Chief Operating Officer from Crimson Fire Apparatus. Next to him is Mr. Mike Moore, who is the Vice President of Business Development for Pierce Manufacturing. Gentleman next to him, Mr. Ken Kreese, who's the Sales Manager for Sudfin Fire Apparatus. Mr. Wilbur, who's moving around here and kind of ducking. We have next to him is Jason Whitmire. Jason is the Pumper Tanker Product Manager for KME Fire Apparatus. And last but not least, Mr. Sean Duffy, who's in charge of government and GSA sales for Rosenbauer Fire Apparatus. So we've got just a great panel here. And these gentlemen have freely given up their time. We're not coerced in any fashion or manner, but would like to, in particular, for Jim, Jason, and Sean, this is either the third or fourth year that they have personally given up their time prior to the show starting to be with us. So again, for everyone, very appreciative of the opportunity to meet and interact in this fashion. So here's the first question we had, and this, again, these were kind of made up by Mike and myself. There's no hard balls or soft balls here, but thought it was particular with the way the economy is going, with a lot of departments having to work a lot harder to justify what their apparatus purchases are going to be, or having their budgets either completely cut or slashed. You maybe went into the budget cycle thinking you were going to have $450,000 for your new custom engine, and after you go through the budget process and the various hearings, you know, the fire chief comes down to your office and says, "We got great news. You know, the news is the budget got approved. You know, the bad news is we just lost $100,000 off the top, and all the work that you did preceding that, you find out, well, we got to throw that out the window. I guess we're not replacing old engine 11 with what we had planned on." So question number one was as follows: what has your company done to adjust in the downturn of the economy with more price-sensitive budgets for new apparatus? So we'll bounce around a little bit, but to start out, we'll start again to my left, Jim Sommy from Crimson. Jim, what have you folks done to try to address those issues?
It's certainly an interesting challenge. Let me just give you a historical perspective on the fire truck industry. 5,500 trucks a year on average. Last year, right around 4,000. Okay, expectation for this year is similar numbers, maybe even less. So in my 30 years, we've never seen that kind of a decline in the marketplace. So, I mean, it's pretty dramatic, and obviously it's the result of the economic conditions of the company, of the country, and how it impacts the fire service and budgets overall. So you have two elements of this as a manufacturer. You say, what products can we develop and provide that offer a good price point, good value, and still are economically viable for us to produce? Because obviously, we still have to be financially responsible in terms of keeping our companies alive. So at Crimson, we've developed a couple products that are really price point conscious. We have a product called the Legend, for example, which is it's really targeted at a under $200,000 pumper price, in a slimmed down configuration. But obviously, when you get into some municipalities, some volunteer organizations, they're wanting more than that. So we've got a product such as that can be price pointed in. The other interesting thing, and I think the challenge even for the room is that now you've got budgetary constraints. How can you adjust your thinking? Because we, as a manufacturer, can't give you $300,000 worth of truck for $200,000. It's just not a viable situation for us to do. So how can you look at how you're using your equipment to perform the function, and you might have to skinny some things down to make it viable.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim. Mike, you know, Pierce for a number of years has had probably got a jump start on some other folks long before the downturn in the economy with your Contender series, and you probably had some pretty good experience with that. But anything else that you've done to tune that up additionally for to address some of the issues that we're facing today?
We certainly have. We've introduced a low-cost pumper. It's our responder pumper, targeting that under the $200,000 range. Also, we've taken steps to expand some of our Contender product line with including some aerial products in that, as well as some larger engine products in that Contender product line. We also have we've maintained a very robust stock program. And part of that stock program, we have quite a few incentives going on with that stock program that's been popular during these times. And, you know, leasing and financing deals, quite frankly, in the terms of financing, in today's market, the money's on sale. Very low interest rates, and we encourage that if you're in the market and you're looking for creative or different ways of getting new equipment, is lease and financing deals out there and exploring those alternatives.
Good, thanks. Two quick points to that, both the comment on Mike's comment. A lot of communities for years, Mike and I have done some work with fleet reviews for people where just traditionally they pay cash on the barrel head for apparatus, you know, or had some funding stream that, because of the age and the financial resources that the organization had, they just were very, very proud that they didn't have to go to bonding or didn't have to look to alternative funding streams. And if the difference is going to be between not buying the apparatus and at least exploring that or chipping away at the brick, so to speak, a little bit, Mike makes a very good point. And to go to Jim's comment on rethinking your needs, largely because of Brother Wilbur. And so far this year, I've visited a number of military bases, had the pleasure of training, doing some engine company operations out in Edwards Air Force Base. You look at between the different DOD divisions, particularly with the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Air Force. Those folks have rethought the way they buy fire trucks as well. The Air Force is buying product from Mike's company as well as the Marine Corps. And where they used to buy full-blown custom apparatus, they're buying stuff from the Contender line and still finding, because of the expansion of what's available, they're not giving up a whole lot. And if your department was used to always starting with the front bumper to spec a rig out and having everything just the way you want, if that's the niche you're going to be in, then God bless you. But understand you're not going to be able to then take that and go over to what the first couple of gentlemen have spoken about and get everything just the way you want. You need to expand your horizons a little bit, and in other jurisdictions where, no matter what your perspective is on how our federal government spends our tax money, I've been very proud when you go to look at what our military fire departments are doing. They're doing a very, very good job with whatever product they're buying and making it work every day of the week for them. So comment on that. Ken, what are you folks at Sutphin done to look at it, adjusting up or having products?
Yeah, we've done a few things. Historically, we were always known as a company that if you wanted to buy one of our trucks, they were pretty expensive. But over the years, we developed our Shield Series product line that took on the idea that we weren't going to change really the components we used to get it to cost less. We were just going to pre-engineer everything. And the difference between those trucks and, say, a high-end custom truck is that if you choose a generator on the truck, we've already got designed where it's going to go. Instead of asking you, well, where would you like us to put it? Those trucks cost a lot more. So what we did is we said, well, we'll pre-engineer the 90 percentile fire truck, and we can build that machine much faster. We can reduce our labor cost to manufacture it. And the swing is about $40,000. So then we took that same idea and we moved it into a commercial product line, which we typically hadn't built over the years. We started building it about a year and a half ago. Oddly enough, called a C-Series, and it's nothing more than its commercial chassis, an international chassis. And then just here this summer, we released what we call our Guardian Series, which is basically the same thing as the Shield. The Shield had kind of gotten priced up, more options to it. The thing had started to get a little more expensive. So we kind of regrouped and released that product line. So those trucks can be bought in that, you know, closer down to the mid-$200,000 range, and the commercials can get slightly under $200,000. But the real trick was to coach our customers to say, listen, I understand you want this particular component mounted a certain way, but if you'll accept it the way we've already designed it, you can save a significant amount of money. And that's the real thing. I think all manufacturers have done that. We have engineered componentry, but what happens in the purchasing process and the committees that form, they tend to get opinions of where things will be. And of course, we want to accommodate. But to do that, that cost starts to, you get three components on a truck and each costs $1,000. And then what happens is if you choose all three of them, they're no longer $1,000 each. It's $10,000 to get all of those to work in unison together. So that's the stuff to try to avoid. And manufacturers, us for one, have really been paying a close attention to that, to try to make sure we coach buyers properly in that.
Good points, Ken. If you look at certain components that we may feel by brand very, really kind of sink our teeth into, the brand of pump, the type of warning light, if you happen to have shutter or roll doors, a brand of roll-up doors with the pre-engineered units, they're pre-engineered with a certain brand so that the manufacturer knows things that work. So those are the types of things that you need to think about, that if you're used to having brand F lights and the options on the program unit are brand W, you got to have to, that's a soul-searching question. Is it worth $40,000 more for you to change the kind of brand of warning light you have? And if you don't have the 40 grand in your pocket, that 40 grand might be better spent on an engine to some more pump or plumbing components or something that's really going to provide you some service, rather than get hung up that I need to have the Wilbur brand of shutter door to find out that that's only available on the custom one. Well, then, you know, give it up. All right. Jason, you guys have had a fair amount of experience there. I know that a couple of years ago down at the show here, you, Mike and I were looking at an engine you had, and were amazed at some of the options, and you said, oh yeah, this is our program pumper, and I'm like, get the heck out of Dodge here. So what have you folks done since that time to change things up a little?
It's been about 2 years now since Canny launched our legacy line, and what we really focused on was trying to get out there with the customers and find out, what do you need on a program unit? So that people used to think of a program unit as just the bare bones, this is the minimal apparatus, and it has only a few options, just exactly what you need, not all of the different things that you're looking for. So what we tried to focus on was coming up with a program unit that addressed all of your needs and saying, okay, this base unit isn't just going to have 4 2.5-inch discharges on it. It's going to have an LDH discharge, because we realized that 90% of the customers want that type of discharge on their apparatus. So we did a lot of research into developing a program line that we thought we could sell right out the gate to a majority of our customers. And it all comes down into the efficiency of the build. Like some of the gentlemen have spoken about here already, it's not about putting cheaper components on your truck. It's not about giving you something that doesn't have the quality that you expect from everyone. We're all looking to get more efficient at what we do. And when we can build a dozen trucks at a shot, maybe even more, 20, 30 units at a shot, our labor force can build it more efficiently and get it out faster, which reduces the labor cost to you and gets you a cheaper apparatus in the end with the same quality that you would expect.
Sean, the same question to you, but I'll throw, I guess, a B part of the question. Mike and I had a chance yesterday to just quick walk around the exhibit floor, but in addition to the program unit, maybe for the benefit of the audience here, what inherent benefits are there, if any, if you had already built a unit? Like, I know one of the units that you have on the floor is a unit that you have in Baltimore County.
Yes.
Pretty specifically done to their spec. But if I took my committee and walked around that, and we're looking at that and saying, you know, we could live with that rig. You know, in addition to program units, is there any kind of potential inherent savings if somebody says, hey, other than the color that's on there and the kind of lettering, I give me that rig and just build it for me. Is there any potential savings by doing a tag on to accept somebody else's design? It to go to Ken's point, a lot, what maybe the audience doesn't understand it, there's an incredible amount of engineering and purchasing effort that goes in behind the scenes that you don't necessarily see when you do the mid inspection or the final inspection. If somebody says, if you've got a unit that you're doing one of a kind, you can be talking about 4 to 8 hours just to engineer the water tank, and then to get those blueprints back and have them approved and to allow the water tank manufacturer to build the water tank. So there's an incredible engineering effort that goes in there that with the program units, as what Ken alluded to, the engineering's already done. You know, unless you throw some, maybe one wrinkle that the manufacturer will either, you know, if you're Sean Duffy, he'll be like, yeah, sure, we'll do that. You know, if you're Jason, you'll be like, well, wait a second, you know, we've built about 300 of these things. Let's go through to see what we've got. Maybe there's something that's close to what you want, not identical, but something we've already done and engineered. So we're not doing it, quote, just for you. Again, there's nothing wrong with that, but if you don't have the piggy bank to back that up, that's where a lot of people get discouraged with some of the things that Mike and I have done. Ask us to review specs prior to going to bid to make sure they're competitive or to make sure the right components are in there. And somewhere along the line, not that we're nosy, you're trying to get into your pocketbook to say, how much do you guys expect to spend or what do you want to spend when you get done? And in a lot of cases, there's $100,000 or greater difference between what the expectation of what the customer wants to spend versus based on our experience of what the bids are going to come back. And nothing, I can assure you, can be more discouraging than to go through the whole process of specing the rig out and then finding out the Visa gold card's been maxed out. Whoever holds the purse strings, the guy with the grayest hair that maybe they got to wheel in, you know, the treasurer to sign a check, there's not that kind of money. Or you go in a commission district or someplace else where the apparatus committee is not well plugged into the financial stream. These guys are out designing the rig of their dreams with everybody getting what they want, and they find out that the money's not in the piggy bank for that. So with that long-winded question, and I know you've got a plane, Eddie Rickenbacker's ready to take you out of here at 11.
I'm very glad you came over here.
Okay. Thanks. That's why I'm an engine guy. The truck guy doesn't say anything. Engine guys, we tend to be a little bit more involved.
Really?
Absolutely.
We're doers. We're not sayers.
Yeah.
Right. Your statement, somebody walks into the floor, sees that Baltimore County truck, Tom, your logic is flawed. They want that truck, that exact truck, just make me do it. It's a flawed statement because this is the American Fire Service. Nobody's going to buy an exact one. But assuming
I can find somebody in the next 3 days to do that and prove you wrong, proceed.
Okay. Yes, there would be a savings. And you made a very good point. I mean, there is a lot of engineering, especially on the Baltimore County trucks. There was a tremendous amount of engineering that went into that. That is a complete custom job where Chuck Rogers and a group of his people from the fleet shop out in Lenard were up in South Dakota for essentially 3 days. And it took up a tremendous amount of time of our engineering team to come up with and match everything, punctuation mark for punctuation mark, everything they wanted. So if we were able to turn around and say, had a customer came in and said, yes, that truck, perfect. You don't even need to change the color. There would be a savings to that customer because a lot of that, the legwork's already been done. It has been done, there is a file, and all it is a clerical part of saying, okay, let's take this back, let's move it over to this folder, let's assign it this job number, and off you go to the races. Now, those trucks were ordered 12, 14 months ago, maybe a little bit longer. I mean, there have been pricing changes that have come along, and there would be adjustments. And of course, you know, some of those trucks are pre-2010. So, you know, in theory, if we didn't have the 2010 issue with the motors, yeah. I mean, there would be a sizable.
Okay, so my challenge now that you've thrown down a gauntlet is to find somebody either for that or somebody that likes the Winchester wagon that's sitting in Mike's booth. I'm going to find somebody in the next 3 days and say, do it.
If you do, I'll leave Columbus on Saturday and I'll drive up to Hamburg and I will wash your car.
I probably need to wait till Sunday because I won't be there, but there will be some bugs on it by about 1,800 hours. Thanks for your offer.
Can I add a point here, Tom?
Sure.
I think Tom made a good point earlier, and it's something to think about as well. When you're talking, how does a manufacturer work with their supply base to reduce cost? All right? So what you do is, in a lot of our program-type vehicles, we'll say, okay, we're going to use brand A valves, all right, and we'll negotiate with them to get a good price because we're going to buy 20 of them, all right? So what we have is some buying power when, in fact, you specify that you want this truck, but you specify vendor by vendor by vendor by vendor. Do you think that vendor is willing to give us a great price? No, because it's locked down. They know they're going to get the business. So some of the advantages in the program truck has to do with our ability to purchase more cost effectively with a higher volume base and some negotiating power with the suppliers.
Good point. And again, understand, the manufacturers are in a very difficult position with the way the economy is, that they're not necessarily being reactionary. If you're looking at several cases, that their versions, no matter what they call them, the program units, have been out there for a while. And I'd have to say, when brand by brand, when they first came out, as Mike and I were going out to talk to people, a lot of folks thought, geez, the manufacturers are trying to almost like, their initial impression from a lot of guys were, they're trying to shove this stuff down our throats. You know, they're trying to play to the municipalities or stuff, understanding that, you know, they're just trying to sell the product. Well, now the dichotomy to me, it's almost been reversed by 180 degrees. A couple weeks ago, I was up on vacation with my wife in New England and happened, as I normally do, to stop at some fire stations. And the first three or four that I stopped in, just asking, you know, the chief officers on duty, hey, what are your plans in the future for buying stuff? And most of them, they just laugh. They're just like, there's nothing going on. One jurisdiction I went, which was nameless, had bought a used Han off of Long Island as their reserve pumper and were just happy to have a good viable piece to run because there was no way that they were going to get money. They'd been shot down 3 years in a row for a new rig. You're looking at in a department where they've got a lot of other places to go spend money. You know, buying a fire truck is kind of important, but putting people on it, typically if you're paying for that, is a heck of a lot more important maybe than what you're running on. So, all right, a lot of us or most of us should all be familiar what happened 2007 with EPA with the engines and some of the initial issues that just about every manufacturer faced with getting those to fit, cool, operate properly. Again, from some of the experiences that Michael and I have had, a lot of what the engine folks told us that, you know, this is bulletproof, you're never going to have a problem proved to be. You hooked up the line meter to them, if it didn't peg all the way, it would peg up, go over a little bit. And now we had to face that again 3 years later in 2010. So question number two was, what manufacturing and in-service problems have you encountered so far with the EPA compliant engines? And we're going to change up the order a little bit, but I'm going to start only with Mr. Son, because in addition to Jim's position at Crimson, he's a sitting member of the 1901 committee and is also a member of the FEMA tech committee. So a lot of times if things go wrong, and we're not putting this on Jim wrong with his particular company's product, he gets a lot of people just dump on him, like, have you heard this? Because I got a phone call, and I was talking just two nights ago to a chief in Southern Maryland who told me something had happened to his rig, and when he told me the scenario, we won't bore you with the details, it's like, from anything you've ever heard, it's like, this absolutely positively couldn't happen, and the chief is saying, I'll put the driver on the phone to you, it happened. So, Jim, what kind of feedback have you been getting, not only with your own product, but some of the things that you found with the 2010 version of the
Yeah. The reality is we've had zero problems because we haven't shipped one yet.
Here, guys, you heard it first. It's zero defense.
But there's a number that are in process in our manufacturing. You know, we're Crimson is a part of the Spartan Motors organization, so we're intimately involved on the chassis engineering side of this. So there are inherent challenges in the engineering of the vehicle associated with just the whole packaging of the exhaust system, the cooling packages, etc. So at this point in time, I think we've looked at it at the Crimson level and the Spartan level. We got testing gone through, and we've proven the cooling systems have performed. We've proven that the emissions requirements have been met. We know we're in compliance with a broad range of engine product offerings, but and quite honestly, we don't have the track time in the field with these products yet to really say whether we're going to experience problems or not. My prior experience in this arena is there will be things that will show up. They won't generally be showstoppers or killers. They'll be correctable things, but we're not a let's build 10,000 of these types of vehicles a year type of industry. So there will be incidences where I'm sure things won't quite work. A lot of people, there are two basic approaches right now, with the SCR technology or with the international approach, which is basically kind of supercharging the EGR and fuel timing. So I don't think anybody's got a ton of vehicles out there with a lot of time, but some of my colleagues here may have a little more experience than I do.
Mike, your perspective on this?
Well, we have four trucks with the 2010 motors that are running around. We've completed a 30,000 mile durability run with one of the vehicles, and we've seen we've been very pleased with what we've seen out there with the 2010 motors. It's the first time, and we're focusing on the SCR route, that's okay. Selective catalytic reduction, where utilize the diesel exhaust fluid, And it's the first time in any emission changes where there's some actual some benefits from that. Increased fuel mileage, we are seeing increased fuel mileage out of the motors. The regeneration that the 2007 motors introduced, that large DPF, that diesel particulate filter, and that regeneration. I mean, if you talk to the engine manufacturers, they'll generally tell you that, you know, in rough terms, it's supposed to regen about every 400 miles is the intervals. The new engines, it's more like every 2,700 miles, so there's a lot less regeneration because the engines are just creating less soot levels. They're creating higher nitrous oxide levels, which get treated downstream in the exhaust stream with the SCR and the diesel exhaust fluid. So we're seeing very very positive results. And one of the things that we've seen, we've had a truck in the field for 3 months now, 3 or 4 months since early spring, where the drivers really like the responsiveness of the engines. They seem to have a quicker acceleration and better responsiveness than some of the others.
Just for clarity, the units that you have out there, Mike, these are stock units that you're running around as demos to show off to folks, so they're pretty much, you're on the road all the time.
Yes, they're okay. Stock units. So we've been pretty pleased with the whole the 2010 engines. A lot of work, as Jim mentioned, there's a lot of engineering challenges in packaging. Not so much the engines, but downstream in the exhaust systems. There's extra componentry in there that has to fit up underneath the truck. And we spend a tremendous amount of time getting the exhaust system and packaging to fit into the same wheelbases that have been that people are used to buying, along with the same type of options. And Pierce is moving down the path of utilizing the same cab. So we're not widening our cabs. We're making all of that fit in packaging. So it's just, you know, and really other than filling up that diesel exhaust fluid tank, which is about a four-gallon tank, and it's very similar to topping off your washer fluid. Other than that, we're working on making that as transparent as possible to the fire departments.
Have we lost any compartment space or anything like that?
No, we're not. It's not impacting the compartment space. We've got some patent pending packaging solutions. It's a mouthful that we're using for the exhaust componentry and packaging of the vehicle that keeps it out of the compartment space. Allows the options up and around in the pump area, the front suctions, the front discharges, the whole suction boxes, you know, all that stuff is still available. So we think it's going to be a good thing.
Good. Thanks, Mike. Ken.
And we've had pretty good success with them. We've delivered about 40 delivered, 42, I think, of the medium block, the 2010 medium block, which is the Cummins ISL product. We haven't delivered any of the big block stuff, although we have six of those installed, a couple in some demonstrators, some of them in customer units in demonstrators, and then some in just some prototypes of new products we're working on. And we have no experience with the big blocks yet, other than what we did back in 2007 is we kind of hedged our bets in terms of what we needed for cooling capacity in 2010, and we hit it pretty good. We ended up not needing any more cooling capacity. Our cab stayed the same, everything stayed the same. It just became a question of how to get all that stuff to fit inside, underneath the cab. And it really became down a question of air management to try to make sure that we manage the air across those engines. That's part of the cooling that's required. And our guys did a pretty good job. So we haven't really seen any impact on that. We're still working through inventory of the big block stuff, the 500 Cummins and the 500 Detroits. We're still working through that inventory, and when that's out, that's when we'll move over to the big block 2010 stuff.
Jason, I know you folks, you had introduced at a show earlier this year, you had, with the redesigned cab there, had the big block, the ISX Cummins in here. What's been your experience with that?
Well, we decided to really complicate it for ourselves to go after both technologies. So K&E has taken the approach of using the Cummins product with the SCR technology, and we've also introduced the International Engine, which is, they're referring to it as advanced EGR technology. We've gone through testing on both units at this point and just wrapped some of that up a week or two ago with the engine manufacturers to get your approval that they can be installed in your chassis and run. The ISX performed very well, but it's a big engine, and people are going to find some differences there on how it consumes that DEF fluid and what it takes to actually run it across the country. I think one of the big things that we're running into and finding is the DEF fluid isn't quite as available yet as they said it would be. Everybody made it sound like you were just going to find this at any gas station right away, maybe even in pumps. And I don't know that we've seen it in pumps anywhere yet, at least up in the Northeast. And when we've run these demos across the country, we've found an awful lot of gas stations that have no clue what you're talking about. When you run in and say, can I get some DEF fluid? They're like, yeah, what are you talking about? We have no idea. So that's one of the challenges right now, is just getting this out there more. I know another big challenge with the DEF technology is the inducement strategy. And Jim can speak on this a little more, maybe. FEMA did some work with the EPA on exactly what we're going to do with fire apparatus. Because they don't, with the typical over-the-road truck, when you get to a certain level, you're going to be reduced to a lower speed. And they kind of step it, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think at one point you may get all the way down to the point where you can only go 5 miles per hour in your over-the-road truck if you've chosen to just ignore the DEF thing. So with the fire industry, FEMA's been really working hard with the EPA to say, look, we can't do this on a fire apparatus. If we're out in a scene and we're pumping at a structure fire for 24 hours, we can't just have the truck shut off while there's guys potentially inside the building or you're protecting exposure or something like that. So we need some kind of a strategy there. And I don't know that it's been approved yet, Jim.
No, it has not. There's a couple people, some folks from Pierce, some folks from Spartan that are kind of leading the charge on that. But, you know, when you talk to government agencies and try to get to people that are technically competent and able to take action, it becomes a bit of a challenge. But I think they've got the right audiences and they've talked to the right people. But and it's just a small tip of the iceberg problem to the government.
I guess they say in a court of law, it's all due respect, you probably need to move those people to New York because I'm from the great Empire State, as Mike. Get Chuck Schumer on that, man. He's everything else there. We'll have that on the 6 o'clock nightly news. We'll have that fixed by all right, Mr. Duffy, we're going to give you another question here because I know you're up. We got an old 1992 model 892 in that plane that's taking you out. All right, so you're going to be good. You're going to be good to go. You're going to be loud. We'll know when you take off there. All right. Everything's been going on. Peter Wilbur, as you know, has been spent a lot of time in seatbelt initiatives, and you're going to continue to see a lot more of that in the future with things with firefighter safety related to the different initiatives from the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. But with respect just to other technologies with respect to apparatus safety, and not necessarily to take it and not to put any heat on Jim, but not things that necessarily become mandated through the NFPA, through the regulation process, but just things that we see from a technology perspective that may be introduced to us in the future. Sean, what types of things do you see coming down the road that can improve and have an impact on firefighter safety when we're operating on or about our rigs?
One of the things that we seem to have in the industry is we seem to have a raging addiction to sensors. And I can see anything that can sense when somebody is doing something that they shouldn't be, especially when a truck is in motion, I can see there being a sensor. We already have that for seat belts. We have that for seating. We have that for door latches or doors not shut. Anything that really that can move, can be adjusted, that can shift in the cab, even if it's secured, there's going to be a sensor. And I think what you're going to see is it's going to be a necessity, but at the same time, it's going to overcomplicate electrical systems. But when you look at it, we're talking about multiplexing, and by that time, as that technology advances, all trucks are going to be multiplexed by that point. But then again, a lot of what goes on, and if you read, if anybody gets the secret list from Billy Goldfeder, I mean, how many times do you see stories about firefighters that are injured or killed in the line of duty because they're in a cab of a truck responding to a call and they weren't wearing their seatbelt? I think part of the technology goes back to the simplicity of we still have a management issue in the fire service where we don't have people that are being told and being managed to not do stupid things. But
point well taken. Jason?
I think one of the areas that you're going to see a focus is going to have to come in is we focus for years now on line of duty deaths. And like you said, with NFPA and the changes that were made in the 2009 edition, I think we've done a lot of work there to try and take that away. The next focus has to be on injury, just injuries. Not something that resulted in a death, but just putting your firefighters out of service and having them injured. And we're talking little things like not having everything stored up high. People are still focusing on getting the hose bed down. There's still a lot of work that can be done in the apparatus industry on just the day-to-day tasks that you do, the repetitive things over and over that we can simplify. Getting the cross lays down lower. You see more and more with the remote controls on deck guns and things like that, so that a guy doesn't have to crawl up on top of the apparatus. Just little things like that, maybe even NFPA a couple, probably 5-10 years ago, had talked about getting some things off of the pump panel, where that pump operator standing operating, so that there's not a charged 5-inch hose next to him coming in. They took the discharges away. You're not allowed to have that large diameter discharge right next to you, but there's still more focus and possibility there on taking everything away from you there, so that you have a safe area to operate.
I have a question of all of you, if you would just, I have been told that one of the major concerns and one of the major litigation points for all of your apparatus are just slips and falls. Is it, would that be as a group that you would agree to that that's really the atypical?
That's the typical for injuries on any kind of vehicle. Slip, trips, and falls are, there's always claims, there's always issues. I'd say the fire truck industry isn't litigious like a lot of industries are, that, you know, every time somebody trips and gets a cut on their knee that they don't sue you. Okay, but there certainly are falls that are off of hose beds and such where people have serious injury and they inevitably end up in some kind of a claim.
Go to Jason's point. We're talking about managing injuries, where Mike has put a lot of his effort over the last couple of years working with Gordon Routley and some others in the seatbelts. One of my goals in life before they slam me in a pine box is to try to eliminate folding steps on fire trucks anywhere. We'll look at apparatus where traditionally you maybe had high side compartments on the left side and low side on the right, and we would put two or three folding steps up the right side adjacent to the pump panel, drop down to go up and climb the access to maybe at one point raise a telescopic light, maybe at one point to grab the nozzle and the booster reel now that doesn't exist, and yet we still put those steps there. If you look at some of the apparatus where now you would be climbing there, and I say, if you're going to put a folding step and you get to the top, even though they're all street legal, they meet the NFPA requirement for the square inch size, they're lighted and there's a little handrail there at the top, I say, when you get to the top and you're in bunker gear, what are you going to do? Do one of these to try to release the strap on the hard sleeve? We need to take a serious look to say, you know, if you're going to put a folding step or something other than a fixed step or a corner step or an access ladder, you have to say, what's the purpose of getting up there other than traditionally we always had two steps on one side and three steps on the other? Jason also made a very good point about called lowering the hose bay. We can take it back to 1972, the city of New York, which was not too famous for being very innovative on much of anything with apparatus design.
Hey,
we're talking engines here. You spent your career on a truck. You don't know what the hell you're talking about anyway. Yeah. Sean, fire up that engine. I might need to be on a plane with you. All right?
Well, Tom, I'm going to hang here for you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you need to just get home before I do so you can watch my car on Sunday. Right. They used a bulk tank, and the hose bed was literally sitting on the frame rails of the fire trucks. Well, now for the last 4 to 5 years, and everybody up here has built them, I would encourage you to look at the rigs that are here on the floor. I know Ken's got a pumper in his booth that's got a low tank on a Gettysburg rig, and I know Mike's got one as well. That people call it an FDNY-style tank or an L-shaped tank. Well, that design of tank, ladies and gentlemen, that's been around for 30 or 40 years. It's just we finally, like, realized that, okay, if you're staying with, like, a 750-gallon tank and less, that kind of lends itself to that design pretty well, you know. You can't do an L-shaped tank on a 1,500-gallon water tank and think you're going to drop the height of the hose bay. But one of the things you'll generally see the two of us do, or at least me, he'll be there, like, coaching me, waiting to, you know, catch me when I fall, is we'll try to climb up the back of rigs in street clothes at shows and then say, try envisioning doing this on an engine where you've got to eventually get up to load the supply line after a structural fire, and then you're doing it on three or four folding steps that, again, completely NFPA compliant, but there's four steps in a straight row, and when you dive into the hose bed to do the half gainer and do the Greg Louganis in there, you're 90-some-odd inches in there. You think that's safe? But yet we'll spend, to my point, we'll spend $10,000 to put a remote control monitor on there that we might use once in 3 years. But at least in my life in an engine company, Lou, you can cover your ears because I know you don't do this crap, right? Every time we go out to a structural fire, we're dropping a supply line in the street, which means somebody, maybe not moi, because I'm 58 years old, I'm going to have the junior guys do it. We're racking the supply line and racking the attack line, right? And now that the hose beds all have to be covered and everything, we've just made it more difficult. So when you look at the back of these rigs, there's a lot of things, and it goes to a point that Mike made a while back. And again, no disrespect to Jim and anybody that's ever served on the NFPA 1901 committee. Is it possible to have an NFPA 1901 compliant rig and not be 100% bulletproof or 100% safe? Absolutely. You can put three or four folding steps on there, and that's an accident waiting to happen. How often, think about this, goes to Mike's point on seatbelts. Have we trained people how to sit in fire trucks and put seatbelts on? Right? Have we trained guys how to climb on and off apparatus safely? Not the ideal apparatus, the apparatus in your car.
Well, we take an awful lot for granted in this industry, and a lot of times it comes back to bite us. Well, I'll get the question of fire chief. I have a mandatory seatbelt policy, and we're trying to enforce it, and I said, your rookie school, how many hours or minutes do you spend teaching firefighters how to ride properly on a fire truck? Well, none. Well, if you don't train somebody how to do that, what the hell do you expect? The same thing, another thing that's a big issue, are Q2 sirens. We all like to have Q2 sirens. How many people have actually been trained on how to properly use a Q2 siren? If you're the kind of officer that gets excited and puts your foot on the pedal and just leaves it there, you have negated, you have negated the use of a Q2 siren. You're supposed to hit all those decibel ranges for all the people out there that you're supposed to be warning of your approach. And so to just put your foot on that device and call it good, you just wasted your money, you wasted your time. But nobody's trained to do that, because we all take it for granted that the minute that you get gold or silver on your collar and you get promoted or you're an officer, that you magically know how to do that stuff. And that's just simply not the case. You can't have these grand expectations if you don't teach people how to do what you want them to do.
Sounds pretty basic, ladies and gentlemen, but it's not important until something happens, then it's really important. You want to leave some time. The time we have left to get
Tom, can I add one point? Because recently there was a major show in Europe called the Interschutz show. Interschutz basically features products primarily manufactured in Europe. And one of the things to your access point is virtually every European pumper, the low side of the compartment is a fold-down step. The roll-down door comes to it, the step folds up, and it forms the base of the door, and you lift the door up, you fold the step down, and now you're basically 24 inches off the ground. They are extremely clever about their ability to roll out, drop down, swing out, push out, to very ergonomically address access to equipment. So you can see a radical difference in the vehicle that shows up there largely to provide better ergonomics and provide a safer environment to get to. It doesn't look like a classic American fire truck, because you see a partial door and a roll-up, but it, from a safety perspective, there's a tremendous advantage.
You mean we might not win a trophy in the crate with that?
Might not. Might be third place.
Tom, one real quick point about
sure.
The bed. If you've got somebody that's specking an apparatus and looking at one of these lower hose beds, don't pay attention as much to where the floor of the hose bed is. Think about where the hose is when it's packed. Because all too often we see both people put this skinny little hose bed, and the floor's all the way down there, and they go, wow, look how low our hose bed is. And then they put 1,000 feet of 5-inch in there, and it's 10 feet up in the air. you got to pay attention to where it's going to
be. Very good point. You do that on a rescue engine where you think you're doing something with a 750L tank, and you want to carry 1,200 to 1,400 feet of 5-inch and 3 tiers wide. By the time you get done, you're still 88 inches off the air. So you still need to put a tag line or do something else to get the hose out of bed. And to a point, that goes to where we have solved some problems with the netting and the safety netting that we now have to have on the rear of the hose beds, and created an issue that if you're going to be pulling the tack lines off the back of the height that you need to get up to the rig, you know, it's one thing to say I've got NFPA 1901 compliant hose restraints, and the standard appropriately doesn't describe how you do that. There's a whole bunch of different ways to do it. But the way some of the manufacturers do it, it looks great, but now you still have to climb to the uppermost step, and you're close to 100 inches in the air to be able to unlatch the netting, or however the restraint system is, so we've created an issue when you're going to do something.
How come, I have a question, Mr. Shannon.
Yes.
How come you engine people have so many issues?
It's because we're doers, Mike. We go out and we make it happen, so when you make stuff happen, just as you say, you know, you can't make this stuff up, you know. You guys just show up, you get out of the truck, some guys go to the fire floor, some guys go to the floor above, and you're just like, you're happy. I generally know you have arrived when I feel your size 10 coming up my backside.
I know you've arrived when I go out into the hallway and say, it's in here, don't worry, it's not too hot.
Don't fire up, man. Rickenbacker's got that engine. Okay, here's our last question, and we'll open it up to some for the floor here, finish things up. Combination apparatus. Mike and I have written, I think we're on part 46 or 47 of the Apparatus Architect. We've been blessed with the folks from Firehouse Magazine, with the support of Harvey Eisner and Jeff Barrington and the folks to be able to write these articles. When we started out, we thought we're going to write one article, maybe see my name in print once. And after we did the first one, they're like, well, when are you guys sending in the next one? We're like, we're not. Why? Do you want another one? So they've given us a lot of editorial freedom, quite candidly, to write about, you know, different topics. They've never put a bug in your ear to say, you got to do this, you got to do that.
Whoa. What? There was one time, the first time, when the harvester said, nah, you can't do that.
You can't do that. But that was you. That wasn't me. I'd be alone. So we've written a lot about combination apparatus. Might could be good, bad, or indifferent. What works in one community may or may not work in the next adjacent community. Right, so combination apparatuses, as quints, rescue engines, other multi-purpose units, they certainly become quite common. What advances and improvements do you see in the future for these kinds of rigs? So we'll go down the road here from my left to right. Jim, I know you guys have just introduced a new unit that you call the transformer, and I think you know, some people think that's like a transformer, some monster.
You know, fortunately, they came out with the toy in the movie before we named it, but we're okay with it. The concept with the transformer is really to analyze what runs are all about these days. The NFPA statistics say 6% of the runs we actually engage the fire pump, and 3% of the runs we actually pull lines. All right, so what it's saying is, and as you're all aware of, is the fundamental job has changed significantly. So the thought behind the transformer product is to provide a high degree of capability for equipment storage, for HRT equipment, so basically minimize the space occupied by the pump, maximize the space in the cube available for storing equipment. And we have a truck, the truck is here, minimize the area it takes for controls, so that basically when you're trying to do the other tasks that you do, you know, 90% of the time, that you have the tools staged, available, and on the truck to get it done. So I think that's one significant look at how the biz is changing, and the trucks have to reflect the capability to do that. Now, you still have to have the task at hand is fighting the fire. You still have to have a very capable pump. You have to be able to carry the water. But if you can maximize all the other benefits and have that capability be very robust, it's, I think, a real neat combination.
Thank you.
Firecom makes wireless communication easy. Over the past 2 years, thousands of happy customers have discovered the benefits of Firecom's wireless headsets. Easy to use and simple to install, Firecom's wireless system is the industry choice for those who demand proven reliability and crystal clear communication. Whether on route, on scene, or during transport, a Firecom wireless system is a distinct advantage when performing critical life-saving services. To learn more about Firecom's complete line of communication products, contact your dealer, sales representative, or visit us online at firecom.com. Firecom, wireless made easy.
Now, Mike, you folks had introduced the puck some time ago, which was a similar concept of minimizing the traditional space that we used, at least on a pumper, for the typical pump operator stand. It was somewhere between 42 to 48 inches at a minimum of space and a lot of weight on the rig. But how has the success of that product been, and what other things do you see coming down the road to assist departments?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we introduced our puck about 2.5 years ago, and we've seen tremendous success with that product line. And as much as Jim touched on it, it minimizes the space that the pump takes up. And what you do with that space is you add compartment space or you add cab space on the vehicle. And that's really, as you sit down and look at a traditional pumper, and it's multiple uses that it sees today, you need to carry more equipment. I mean, when was the last time anybody pulled equipment off of a truck? Always added new equipment to a truck. So compartment station space is big. And what we've seen a trend certainly over many years is, you know, as your responsibilities get more varied, you have to carry more equipment, and the result of that is bigger trucks, and you start making compromises. You compromise maneuverability, you compromise cab space, you compromise service access and ability. There was always a compromise there. By minimizing the pump, we're allowed to keep that truck still highly maneuverable, additional compartment space, carry all the equipment that you need to carry in those jobs, but still have the big water capabilities there when you need it. Because when you need it, you need it. And a lot of that is changing how pumps are driven from traditional that allows us to get into that. So I see that trend continuing. We actually carry a lot of that over into our responder and our commercial pumper that we introduced about a year ago. So we see that trend continuing throughout the apparatus builder.
To both Jim and Mike's points, very valid in terms of the amount of equipment that we're going to carry. A couple of communities that Mike and I worked in recently, that was one of the rationales that in small, little, all-volunteer departments, they were able to justify to the people who held the purse strings why they needed a new rig, a combination of the age of the unit versus the NFPA standards, but had, in one case, actually showed up and had digital photos. Here's the equipment of what we carry today. The unit had already been modified twice. Here's what we would like to carry. Here's pictures of stuff sitting on the apparatus room floor. If we get this kind of run, we got to actually take something out of a compartment and throw it in and use the additional carrying capacity as a selling point for their community to justify, in one case, why they were going to spend $492,000 for a new custom pumper.
Well, the mission's changed. I mean, years ago, when I first started, we had a 47 Mac pumper, 300 gallons of water, some 2.5 and some 1.5 inch, and we went to a few fires and called it good. Now we're prying people out of cars, we have airbags, technical rescue, EMS, and hazardous materials, and I went to my first bomb drill the other day, a bus bomb drill. By the way, if you're first due on that, you're probably dead. But they didn't put that in a contract 30 years ago when I signed on to be in the city. But with that said, our mission has drastically changed. And I think that the manufacturers have, all to them, kudos, have done a good job in changing with us and trying to provide additional space for that additional equipment that we have to carry now. They've done a pretty good job of that.
I tell you, to that extent and that movement, we expect to see the 500th sale of that puck later this month. So I mean, that's where the trends are headed.
Yeah, as much as Mike and I, from our personal backgrounds and our traditions of both of us for 30 plus years in the fire service, favor traditional engines and traditional ladder trucks without pumps. When you get into other parts of mainstream America, several weeks ago I mentioned I was out in California visiting a few LA County fire stations, and for the first time in my life saw a Tillard Quint, all right, that had a pump and tank on it. And I'm asking them, well, how many I call it a street assignment. You get a structural fire, a building across the street goes on fire. How much apparatus are you putting on the street? And the guy tells me 7 engines, 2 trucks, 2 battalion chiefs, and an EST unit, EST. And I'm like, what is an EST unit? It says go over to station 33 and you can see it. It's a little two-person manpower squad that can run anywhere in the battalion just to provide additional staffing. And that's the same. We're not running all this stuff on this because we need all this apparatus. We need it because we need to get the staffing there. And the second new ladder truck is like 20 minutes away, and that's it. There isn't another alternative. In Mike's jurisdiction, if they're a little late getting out of the box, or in a lot of different volunteer departments, particularly in the urban area around Maryland, if you know you don't have the station staffed and you're 30 seconds late, you may have been second due on a ticket, you're going to be third or fourth due. All right. So different people have different applications, and you know, we need to be keep that in mind. So we have enough time to be able to get these gentlemen to respond back to any questions that we have from the audience. Any guys have questions? We'll come down with the microphone and we'll get it on the air and get one of the gentlemen, whoever wishes to respond back, to get your question answered for
you. Folks, now's the time to have your shot. It's not going to get any better than this. You have a lot of brain power.
Okay. Tom has stopped talking to somebody.
Go ahead, you are?
My name is Gary Lessing. I'm with City New Brunswick Fire Department, New Jersey. Gentlemen, the question I have to you is, it's been my experience, I've just taken over the logistics division about a year and a half ago, that our engineering costs are the main expense in a fire truck. They're all pretty much the same. Everybody uses Meritor, everybody uses Rockwell. That's all the same. With today's financial climate being what it is, what is the, and I think this gentleman from Rosenbauer, I think I brought it up, what is the perhaps looking at some trucks that were built? Of course, no one wants one exactly like someone else's.
Well, Tom said he's going to find somebody.
Well, but that's a challenge for Tom. What I would like to see is the availability to say, hey, listen, there's some trucks that we've built for other towns. The engineering costs have been occurring. They've had grid committees that have sat down, spent the time, the hours, effort put into this truck. And we can say, hey, listen, this is kind of what you've got now. Here's something that's similar. Here's something you're looking to move forward with. And we've done a truck very similar to this for this town in Washington State.
Yeah, if you look at, and don't worry, I'll take care of you. So, if you look at Rosenbauer's website, if you look at Candy's website, Jim, I don't know if you have the tag on. Do you have the tag on with you? Most of the manufacturers out there have a part of their website where you can jump on and you can find a truck that is pretty close to what you're looking for, that may already be in existence and that cost has already been done. It's called a tag. There is also, and being from New Brunswick or being from New Jersey, you know that everything has to go out to bid in New Jersey. In other parts of the country, Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Tennessee, there are states that have state statutes that allow for intergovernmental cooperative purchasing. And that basically says, okay, I found the truck, Mr. Purchasing Manager, I found this truck that is exactly what I'm looking for, and here's the price of all we need to do is issue a purchase order. Could you please sign? And it is truly legal. Our website has a listing of trucks just like that, where, and basically any truck that we build is taggable, except for New Jersey. Same thing with KMA, same thing with Pierce, same thing with Crimson. All manufacturers capable of doing it. There is a website out there, it's called HGACbuy.com. It's a Houston-Galveston area cooperative, and it's a purchasing cooperative based out of Texas that one of the things that they have on their site is called the authorizing statutes. And you pull that up and there's a map, and it'll show you a map of the United States, and you click on your state, and it will tell you it'll give you the actual state statute that says here's what you can do for purchasing from an intergovernmental standpoint. Now, in Pennsylvania has a cooperative purchasing program called CoStars. Ohio has what they call the state term schedule. Florida has the Florida Sheriff's Contract. Mm-hmm. There is Lamas in Louisiana. There is the HGAC and the Buy Board in Texas. A lot of trucks are bought off of these contracts because a customer can say, or a fire department can say, hey, I can save myself a lot of time by buying a truck that's already been designed. And from a municipal standpoint, you can save yourself a lot of time and you can save your, in New Jersey, I believe they're called solicitors or law directors, solicitors. Save your solicitor a lot of time, too. All the work's already been done. He doesn't need to sit there reviewing all that documentation and saying, you know, trying to find a legal, you know, something that might be illegal simply because it's already been done. So your city is not spending the money on fees to pay for that solicitor. So overall, yes, there are plenty of opportunities out there. You can see it, you see a truck, and it is very easy to go ahead and just say, sure, we can tag onto that, that's not a problem. But one thing I would caution you on is if you find a truck that is 3 or 4 years old, we'll take, you know, let's fast forward to say 2014, assuming, you know, using Tom's example of Baltimore County, well, let's say, you know, somebody in, you know, well, New Brunswick wants to buy a truck just like that Baltimore County truck. Well, there has to be a component in there in the contract that allows for price adjustments based on PPI, based on component price increases or decreases, changes to governmental and quasi-governmental regulations, i.e. the EPA and our friends at the NFPA.
So you don't, Billy, you don't have to reinvent the wheel?
No, but Tom likes to.
He's an engine guy. You have to excuse him. Let me ask.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. A tag on to that, isn't there certain states that if you construct the apparatus there, the state fire departments within that state get preferential purchasing power?
Yeah.
Is there deals?
You can answer that one, Jason, because you do in Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania, you do, yes.
I think something in Ohio as well, right? Do you?
No, there's no preference. We're trying. We'd like it to be that way, but it hasn't happened yet. Okay. Some cities have some preferences, but
yeah. Okay. I think it's an extra $10,000.
That's my next objective.
From the state for a loan.
We have to pay it back.
Yeah.
Okay. Another question for our esteemed panel. Okay, who do we have here, and what would you like to ask?
My name is Charlie Ford. I'm from Long Island, and maybe it's just my imagination, but I feel the rigs are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And with the traffic on Long Island, what my department did, we have a 42-foot rear mount aerial ladder. We designed an aerial ladder 36 feet long, and we put all the equipment in it just by the kids making cardboard compartments out of it. We carry all the rehearsal equipment, firefighting equipment, and shoring equipment. I'd just like to know, am I just imagining this? Are they getting bigger?
I'll speak to a couple points. When you look at what's happening on the front of the truck, which is, you know, the cab area, we've basically been driven to get wider and wider because of the cooling packages that are needed. So essentially, you'll see a lot of cabs now that are in that 100-inch wide neighborhood with the big block engine, some a bit narrower. So you've got the cab is kind of encompassed by what it has to do to accommodate the cooling needs. I agree with you on the vehicles. You know, we've gotten long, we've gotten tall, but largely because people keep asking for more and more and more. I don't think is the manufacturer willing to do less and less? They truly are.
That's my question to you. You know, as a manufacturer, how can you just keep going? Because you know it's corporate action, people what they want.
It's tough in the fiber industry because if I say no, someone else is going to say yes.
Somebody else will build it.
So it's very difficult.
Yeah, it's finding the solutions for that problems. We saw that, quite a while ago. And I touched on that. You carry more and more equipment. You mentioned that. Carry more equipment, the compartments get bigger. And we heard that loud and clear. You know, I got to carry it, but I don't want the truck to be any bigger. Make the truck smaller, but give me more compartmentation.
What we did is
right?
The kids make the compartments out of cardboard boxes, and we fit, all make sure it fit in there. And we knew the dimensions of the compartments, and we shrank the truck 6 feet.
Yeah. That's what we did with our puck, and Jim's got Transformer, and some of the other companies have some other products where we were able to look at what takes up the room on that, and you look at an engine. It you've got the cab and it is what it is and that motor, and then you want a big pump in there and that takes up, you know, getting to be 5, almost 6 feet of wheelbases in a lot of cases, and then you say we need a big compartment on the back, and that gets so much bigger. So we're looking at things like our POC, where we change the how we drive the pump. We still have a lot of capacity with the pump at 1,500 gallon per minute. You still have all your discharges and locations, but we're reconfiguring that to get those trucks smaller, but yet with the larger compartmentation. And to your point, you know, the more that we can work with up front with, you know, exactly what equipment, and the fire department can identify what equipment it is and exactly the compartment space you need, we can tailor the vehicles to size that accordingly.
Well, that's a big pet peeve of Tom and ours as it relates to the inventory of the equipment and the weight. You mentioned height and largeness of the vehicle, but often what goes away is the weight. And we continue to go around and do fleet evaluations, and we have people weigh their trucks, and only once in the last 4 years have we been to a firehouse and had all the trucks make weight on all the axles. And then you talk about accidents which occurred like in the city of Boston, and there was one just this week where a fire truck, I believe in Pennsylvania, we keep losing our brakes. Well, why are we losing our brakes? And why are we breaking springs? And why are tires failures at a record level? And all that has to do with just trying to fit 10 pounds of crap in a 5-pound bag. And a lot of times it just doesn't work. And like, you know, these are all reputable builders here. Not everybody may be so. And, you know, if you really, really, I remember a story from my good friend Tom here. He went to a firehouse and this department really wanted a $44,000 foam system, but he said, well, that's going to be a maintenance nightmare, it's going to plug up the gauges, you're going to have trouble, why don't you try the $18,000 foam system, it'll make just as much foam, it'll be way less of a maintenance headache, and it'll be cheaper and more cost effective. And what did the Trump committee chairman do? I want the $44,000 foam system, if you don't build it for me, then I'm going to go somewhere else. And so a lot of times it's not the manufacturing sector, but rather it's us as consumers that we get banging our, I know what we need, and I, do you really? Do you really know the components of the truck? Do you really know? We think we know. A lot of times we say we know, but in most cases, a lot of times we just don't know because the industry has changed so much over the course of the last 15 or 20 years as technology moves us forward. Another question.
Tom, or Mike, if I could just go back to the point you were making about parking. I did that a couple years ago with a rescue truck. This was a customer that said that they absolutely, positively had to have a 24-foot rescue. Absolutely. They couldn't get anything. They couldn't have a body that was small. They ended up with an 18-foot body and saved themselves about $75,000 in the process. The thing that was amazing is they went to a local appliance store and just grabbed refrigerator boxes and did exactly what you described. Have the kids cut them up, do whatever, and package it all up. They actually
it worked great for us. I mean,
they knocked 6 feet off the length of the truck because I think a lot of people, and I would encourage anybody in this room that's going to be going through this process, especially on a truck the size of a rescue or a rescue pumper with the amount of weight that you're going to have. These guys just made it. They pulled a number out of thin air. It's got to be this, okay, based on what? Well, that's what we kind of need that. And kind of talked to them, you know, it was myself. There was another salesperson there, and then it was the president of the fire company. The president of the fire company really leaned on these guys and said, think about this. And about 2 months later, they had it all figured out. They saved themselves $75,000 in the body and chassis. So It's a very logical way to go about it. I'm sorry to...
Oh, that's okay. If there was actually a department in Maine that Tom and I are intimately familiar with, and they actually did it out of wood. They had a carpenter, and before they went out and specced out a truck, they designed their compartments. And that's always been a big pet peeve of ours as well. The days of pulling out the old one, backing the new one in, and picking the equipment up off the apparatus floor and saying, what are we going to do now? Those days have to be over, for sure. Before a piece of metal is cut by any of these guys, you should know exactly what's going to go in that compartment, how it's going to fit, how it's going to be mounted, and you need to go from compartment to compartment. And another thing that we always say as well, the more work that you do on the front end of your project, then the easier it becomes over the life of the project, and by the time you get to that final inspection, it's basically a bump. Okay, but you have to put the time and the effort in, and like building compartments and doing things like that before you ever start out is really an excellent way to go. One more question. You are,
Mike, we're in a process of buying a new engine. What is the disadvantage or advantage of me handing you a check for the whole amount or leasing one and knowing then 5 years when we get another?
Leasing, you mean a replacement program, sort of where you're going to...
Yeah, so we have a couple more Allen who decide to get 7 of them all the same.
And then replace them in 5 years. Well, one of the problems is tax law. I mean, municipal leasing, tax-free municipal leasing allows for really low interest rates. If you're going to have a replacement program where it has a residual value, like you would lease a car, those can get into a little bit of tax issues. You want to talk to your banker before you do that because those can be taxable. So it could drive up your cost a little bit. The ones where you're really buying it, it's more a loan. Just loan financing, those are tax-free. So you want to talk to the banker and make sure that they understand whoever you're doing the work with, that they don't get you in a situation where you end up with tax due 5 years ago because someone didn't inform you properly.
More up front, and then at the end, you still want to pay.
Yeah, there could be some tax implications, and then just be careful with it. Either way, they all work pretty well, but you just have to make sure you don't get into a tax situation with it.
Yeah, on a leasing program where it basically releases the vehicle for 9 or 10 years, it has little or no residual value. That's a straight depreciated lease. You basically have nothing left at the end. You know, what that does for you as a department is I'm going to buy my fleet of vehicles and I'm going to be making payments that are way less on an annual basis or on a monthly basis than I would be paying if I had to come up with the $5 million up front. So it really, and you also have what they call payment in arrears, so you can actually get the vehicle and not make your first payment for a year, but you'll be paying that an extra year at the end.
The other advantage to a lease is that you're basically paying for it over its useful life. So say you do a 10-year lease. By the end of 10 years, it's useful life in terms of, depending on how you run it. If you're a real rural department, then its useful life would be 20 years. But if you're more urban, 10 years, that way you haven't had to lay out all that money. You can use that money for something else in a municipality or whatever, roads, libraries, whatever the case is. So there's some real advantages to financing right now, especially with, like Mike said earlier, he says, there's some good deals on money. So
money's for sale out there. But, on the other hand, if you have the cash up front, and there's a lot of manufacturers offering very
prepaid
discounts. Basically, they're using your money to go buy components to build the trucks.
Okay, before we do that, though.
Performance bond.
Okay, you need to have bid bonds, and you need to get it done in Brad Street from each of the manufacturers that are going to bid your project. Because we've had departments out there twice over in the last few years that have made prepayments for chassis. They didn't take ownership of the chassis. And then the department went belly up because they used the chassis money to operate the company. And now the department has no chassis because the chassis owner, the builder, repoed it, and they have no money. And that's happened with a couple of manufacturers that have gone out of business. So if you are going to would you give me $20,000 right now? Why not? I'm a nice guy. I'm a good guy. I'm not getting money here. Well, he's an engine guy. He has no sense of what's good or bad anyway.
I only give it to him if the truck's doing the meal. That's it.
But in any event, you wouldn't give me well, then why would you give somebody a huge sum of money and not take ownership of anything doing that? In a lot of cases, what we're telling people to do, I'll give Pierce or something, I'll give them $200,000 as a prepayment for the chassis once they get the chassis done, and then you're going to give me some kind of ownership papers for that, so that if that company goes belly up, at the very least I have the chassis, you can take it somewhere and get somebody to put a body on.
Keep something in mind, and I'll repeat something that I said here at the podcast last year. I mean, we sat in this room last year, and we had just come out of We're still in the middle of GM's bankruptcy, Chrysler's bankruptcy, Goldman Sachs collapsed. You had, the entire financial crisis, and my statement back a year ago was, who among us would have thought a year ago sitting here that our economy could have just about melted down, that our financial system just about collapsed. And we all just kind of went, yeah, you're right. You got companies out there that are big names that fail. And Mike made a very good point, just because you're a nice guy, really do your research. I mean, no matter who it is, make sure and don't rely on somebody in your department that plays the stock market and understands finance. Get a qualified CPA, get a qualified attorney to review the financials of every manufacturer you're going to consider, especially if they're asking for money up front. Because in essence, once it's gone, it's gone. I mean, you'll go through legal battles to get your truck. Look at people. I mean, not to bring up, some companies, but American of France. I mean, they had, they went bankrupt a couple of years ago, and there's still customers out there that are waiting for their trucks. So,
well, and a customer of ours, and it's good, when I would have brought that company up, we had a department that had bought an American LaFrance LTI tower, and they wanted to maybe marry it up with a pumper, a rescue pumper, of the same like kind design, standardize the fleet, all those things. And all they did is ask for a Dun & Bradstreet with each bid package. Well, guess what American LaFrance refused to do with their bid? They refused to give them a Dun & Bradstreet, a financial perspective. So their bid was disallowed as being unresponsive. And then a couple months later, they went belly up. So there's a reason that we write the articles that we do. There are a series of steps that you can take, like getting Dun & Bradstreet's bid bonds, performance bonds, to protect yourself in your communities. And I would even ask it of any of these folks here. And they will provide one for me, and everything will probably be all right. But if it is not, okay, a year from now, something happens to one of these companies, and the city administrator comes to you, well, what did you do to protect our interests? I got Dun & Bradstreet. At the time I signed the contracts, mayor or administrator, whoever it is, this company was a viable company. What happened in the next year, I don't know. It's due to economic forces beyond our control. So you have covered yourself and your department and have acted responsibly, and any of these folks up here, they're all quality vendors, would be more than happy to provide that support and documentation to you.
I'd like to wrap up, and we'll go down the line here to any other party comments or thoughts on anything, starting with Mr. Sami.
I think it's a little bit of a new day, and I think a challenge to you guys in the room and listening is that if the mission has changed, your thought process has to change too. Okay, and you have to adapt to the economic environment and the reality of what you're dealing with. As a manufacturer, we can look at the trends and say, we see this as something that you really need. It's affordable, it's effective, it'll do the basic job, it goes through your needs. But then the tradition steps in and says, but that's not how we do it in the fire service. And I think we're in a kind of an interesting stage in our business as to there's an economic reality that's maybe more intense than we've seen before, and maybe some of our mindsets about how we have to do our business and how creative we have to be in our thinking about the products we buy needs to be rethought.
Jim, thank you very much. Mike?
I agree with Jim 100%. It's different today than what it was. There's a different product out there. There's different ways to buy a truck. We just went through the leasing stuff. Protect yourself. Whatever you do with your money, protect your community. These are trying times, and we've seen what happened in the automotive industry. Make sure you protect yourself with performance bonds out there, if you're doing prepayments. But pay attention to what's happening here, with that on that side. Money's on sale, so there's some great financing and leasing available out there if you need to go that route. So there are bright spots in this type of economy when you look at it from that perspective. So interesting times.
Mike, thank you. Ken Creech?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing as he was talking. Is when you look at, if it's a foregone conclusion that you got to buy a fire truck in the next 18 months to 24 months, you might as well buy it right now. You won't get price structures for fire trucks as good as they are today. There's some of us that are still sitting on pre-2010 motors that are priced accordingly. There's some of us that have not had price increases in the last 18 months because the economy says that we shouldn't. You know, to keep our pricing down, we're sort of absorbing things and taking lower margins on trucks, trying to just, you know, keeping the companies going, keeping all of our people employed. So if it's a foregone conclusion to do so, then look at financing. You know, financing is as good as it's going to get right now. There's some things that you can do. I mean, your need for fire trucks hasn't gone away, just the amount of money that you have to buy them. You still need equipment. So there's ways to get it out there. Talk to people, talk to the manufacturers, talk to salesmen you're friends with. They can find ways to help you get that stuff done.
Thank you. Jason.
I think one of the big things that has to continue to develop more is the teamwork between the end user and the manufacturer. You have the, you know what you need in your fire district. You know what your needs are and what you have, what services you have to provide. Not to sound like, you know, they call us experts, so-called experts. We've seen it over and over as we're building all these apparatus. So when you tell us what you need, you got to be willing to listen a little bit to the experience that we've gained from seeing other people do it and maybe succeed or not succeed and take that feedback and develop an apparatus that will work better for you.
Jason, very, very good point.
Good point.
Jason's company is building a ladder truck for a department that was in my home county, Rockland County. It's replacing a 1970 Peter Pirsch, all right? I met with those folks, great bunch of guys, but there was like three guys on a committee that were around in 1970 the last time they bought a fire truck, all right? There's somebody had to change their thinking. When I left that night, I thought I was going to have to call the cops to have them get me to the Haverstraw town line because they weren't too happy with some of the things I was saying. But if you haven't adjusted up your perspective and your parameters of what you're thinking of, and Sean, I'm going to let you, as Mr. O'Reilly would say, I'm going to give you the last word, but I can take any one of these, any one of your five program pumpers, and I can still put the Tom Shan stuff on. I'm just going to take it to my dealer, put the dual Mars lights and a rotary on it. I am happy as well, okay? So with that, Mr. Sean Duffy, with an airplane waiting for him in the Inner Harbor, you have the last word.
Okay. Everybody here made a very good point, made very valid points, the things to think about, but I want to go back to something that Jim Salmi said. You know, the mission is changing. And I'll bore you with some very basic statistics. USFA, last year of numbers available, is 2007. Fire departments ran 25.4 million calls in 2007. That's the last year the stats are available. How many of those do you think were fire? 451,000 structured fires. 131,000 that were multiple. 750,000 car, brush, dumpster fires. Biggest one was what? Anybody? No. 17.5 million EMS calls. I'm sorry, 15.5 million EMS calls. The top 100 busiest fire departments in the U.S., 76% of their calls are EMS. We're not burning as much as we used to, and the mission is changing. And Jim made, and Mike also, they're both saying, we're all saying the same thing. You've got to look at where your relevance is. What is important to the communities that you serve, being prepared, but also being responsible for being able to react to the calls that you're going to be responding to the most.
Sean, thank you. I'd like to today just wrap up by thanking Jim Salmi from Crimson Fire, Mike Moore from Pierce Manufacturing, Ken Kreese from Sutphin Fire Apparatus, Jason Whitmire from KME, and Sean Duffy from Rosenbauer for then spending a couple of just real great time with us today. For Mike Wilber and Tom Shan, the Apparatus Architects, live from Baltimore, Maryland, Firehouse Expo. Like, thank you very much. Stay safe. Be good.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.